giving at-risk juveniles on the First Coast a second chance. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. First Coast Connect is always live at 9, and now never miss a show. Catch our daily podcast on iTunes. Just ahead, we'll take your calls on the growing push for civil citations rather than arrest for teen offenders in the city. What do you think? Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, marking Public Service Recognition Week with a special talk at UNF, plus how an old historic downtown building is set to become the hot new downtown dining destination. We'll tell you about the Cowford Chop House, all of that ahead. But first this morning, it's a timely community dialogue about civil citations. Thursday night at the Downtown Main Library, strategies will be laid out on how to generate more support for the implementation of civil citations for first-time juvenile offenders in the city. This issue has come up in the ongoing campaign for Jacksonville Sheriff. Here to tell us more, we welcome Lawrence Hills, director of the local district's teen court. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us, attorney Rob Mason with the Jacksonville Public Defender's Office.
Good morning.
And Crystal Freed, chair of the Jacksonville Human Rights Commission. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. What do you think about the growing momentum to increase the number of times a nonviolent teen who offends or breaks the law is given a civil citation rather than arresting the teen and creating a criminal record for him or her? We want to know what you think. Give us a call. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. We also welcome your comments on Facebook. Crystal, let's begin with you. The Jacksonville Human Rights Commission put this event together. How come?
Well, Melissa, the commission was started back in 1967, and I believe that the reason we existed then is the same reason we exist now. When we look at the city back in 1967, it grew out of its times. There was a lot of unrest. And I'm going to bring that forward to the unrest we see in cities like Baltimore, like Ferguson, and all of the distrust of police officers. It's incumbent on the Human Rights Commission to keep its pulse on the community and things and issues that the community is concerned about, we as a commission want to handle. Number one, to promote civil discourse. I think in the city of Jacksonville, we really need to understand all sides of different issues. There are a lot of passions that come with issues, and that's okay. But the Civil Rights Commission, the Human Rights Commission, excuse me, for the city of Jacksonville, looked at this issue and saw a need. So we've pulled together all these partners to come and inform the public on May 7th, which is tomorrow, at 5:30 p.m. at the Jacksonville Public Library.
And Lawrence Hills, you'll be on the panel. You're the director of Teen Court, where teens who get into trouble come before a judge. Why is this issue of civil citations of such importance to public safety in this circuit, in this part of Florida?
Certainly. I think it's really important for young people to have an opportunity to redeem themselves without having a criminal record. I would venture to say that many of us that hold prestigious positions today, when we came up, we had an opportunity to make a mistake and correct that mistake and to move forward in our lives. With the young people that we see, many of them don't have a clue that they know what they're doing is not necessarily something good, but they don't know that it's criminal. So it's important for a kid to come to teen court where we have law professionals explain to them particular laws that are pertinent to them, like petty theft, possession of marijuana less than 20 grams, and to kind of explain the law and the legal terms in layman's terms for those young people.
And if you're just joining the show, Crime and Public Safety leads us off this morning as we discuss tomorrow night's community forum on civil citations for teens. We'll go to your calls in just a moment. Let us know what you think at 549-2937. Rob Mason, you're with the Public Defender's Office. At this forum tomorrow night, either State Attorney Angela Corey or a representative will be on hand. State Attorney Corey has received a lot of pushing on this issue as activist groups, lawmakers, groups like the people here in studio today have asked that more teens in this judicial circuit be given civil citations. This circuit is lagging behind other Florida municipalities in the way, in the number that it awards to teens. Why is that?
Well, ultimately, the decision that is made in terms of who would get the civil citation or whether it would be allowed is is going to be from the state attorney's office or law enforcement. And they're the ones that control it. And we do very poorly in Duval County compared statewide. And it's not just that we're below average. I don't want to be average. I want to be well above average. And Duval County in the last reporting period only gave 33% civil citations to eligible children, whereas in Miami-Dade, that was 90%. In Pinellas, it was 80%. In Broward, it was 68%. There's no reason that we can't do the same thing.
And what are the arguments against doing it, if you talk to the prosecutor's office?
Their argument, one of the reasons we have such a low rate is they're not allowing batteries and they're not allowing resisting without violence. And I believe we're the only county in the entire state that has the combination of both of them. So that lowers the numbers tremendously. It's over 500 children in the last reporting period that were not even eligible. And the reason I think this is such a mistake is that if you give a civil citation at first and don't make an arrest, the state attorney's office has the ability to review the case. And if they believe the case should be prosecuted in court, they can do so. Whereas if you make the arrest, you really can't unarrest somebody.
Crystal Freed, the argument for increased civil citations is the arrest record follows the teen pretty much forever.
That's correct. And I think one of the misconceptions, and Rob and I were talking about this earlier, is that when you're a juvenile and you have a record, it all of a sudden goes away when you're an adult. And I think Rob can sort of elucidate the listeners as to that is exactly not the case, Rob or
and
Lawrence.
That is a very common perception. And it once you turn 18, it does not change things.
Lawrence, here's a tweet from a listener. Sending kids to jail makes them more likely to lead a life of crime. That's bad for them, bad for their victims, and costly to society. These are the types of themes, I take it, that will come up at the event tomorrow night.
That is absolutely correct. All the studies show that if you expose a kid to a criminal system, that likely they will take on those traits. So we're trying to avoid altogether a kid coming into the criminal justice system. We have the teen court program where they come before a jury of their peers. And it's one thing for adults to say, hey, this is unacceptable behavior. It means a lot more when it's coming from peers saying, hey, we won't tolerate this. This is unacceptable behavior. In addition, Melissa, we have the Neighborhood Accountability Board. And that process does exactly what you're describing and allows the community to come out to wrap their arms around these young people.
So and this is the idea, I'm sorry, of restorative justice. And I'm a mother. And, you know, you kind of learn things as you go along because there's no playbook, right? When I was thinking about, okay, when my kid did something like lie, for example, do I just, you know, put them in the corner on timeout? Really, that doesn't change the behavior. We have to understand and get to the root of it. And I believe restorative justice is a good model because for the first time, the teen can face the person that they hurt. They can realize that their actions have consequences. And then it's not a get out of jail free card because they have Lawrence. You can speak more intelligently, please.
Certainly, continue. I think that's one of the misconceptions and one of the reasons there's some reluctance by law enforcement. I have several law enforcement friends who've explained that they feel as if it'd be a slap on the wrist, and we want to explain and get the word out, and we think that this is the proper format. This workshop will be to explain that it's not a slap on the wrist. Oftentimes, these kids are going to get a lot more than they would get if they went to court and were put on probation.
And to our callers, do you think civil citations for teens are a slap on the wrist or an appropriate way to handle youthful misbehavior? We want your calls, and we'll go to the phones in just a moment at 549-2937. Rob Mason, if a teen is given a civil citation, what's the process from there?
Well, what happens is Lawrence at teen court gets notified and the state attorney's office, they get notified. They review the case to make sure that a child is eligible. And even if a child is eligible, they have the ability to change that decision. After that, the child is referred to teen court to go through the program that Lawrence has described. If they don't successfully complete it, then they're likely to end up in court.
Right, and let's go to your calls right now. What do you think about the increased push on the First Coast to give teen offenders a civil citation rather than an arrest? This is for nonviolent teen offenders, mind you. 549-2937. Jody in Mandarin. Hi, Jody. Good morning.
Good morning. Hang on, let me turn off my, off the radio.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, turn that down.
Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Good morning to all your guests, friend and colleagues with each of them. I volunteer in teen court as a judge, and I have for a couple of years now. It's very rewarding to me personally, but I just want to call in support of the program and the process. Because as I like to explain to the young people when they come before me, you don't wake up when you're 18 and all of a sudden know how to be an adult and how to live in the world and how to handle all the responsibilities that you're expected to handle as an adult, including following the law. And quite frankly, in our society, they don't get any practice in following the law. They get practice in facing consequences, perhaps, if they get slammed with the delinquency court process and get in trouble or get face-to-face with Officer Friendly or a police officer out in the street or hang with the wrong crowd. They get immediate, very heavy, very frightening consequences, which cause young people to close down. They're not developed yet. Their thinking processes and their judgment, their ability to make judgments and think independently and think critically is not yet developed. And they behave like adults in terms of bravado and anger and all of those sorts of things that we think make them, look like maybe little miniature adults or younger versions of grown-up people, but it's just not so. And I've been very, very thrilled with the outcomes of the young people who come before me. They listen, they pay attention, they really engage, and they recognize they're given an opportunity to make a choice right then and there if they want to make something out of the rest of their lives or if they want to run scared for the rest of their lives. By heading down a path that is sure to increase their chances of being unhappy, unsuccessful, and frustrated and angry.
That's Jody in Mandarin. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Jody. Lawrence.
Yeah, some of these kids, Jody is absolutely correct. Some of these kids actually, they have no intent on doing anything criminal. They actually are going to be mischievous. Some of us were when we were growing up, but they don't want to be criminals. So they don't have a knowledge of what criminal laws are. We do the explanation for them, and I tell you, many of these kids will go on to do well. One of the other things I will mention is that with every kid that comes to civil citation, there is a assessment that's done for needs, and many of these kids we're finding have mental health and substance abuse needs that are going undocumented. So although we may be getting a kid that stole a bag of chips at a retail store, once we do an assessment, we find that they've been through all kind of trauma that has gone undetected. And if we don't have the time to address that in a format like teen court or neighborhood accountability boards, they're likely going to reoffend again.
And I think the issue, too, comes down to what kind of society do we want to have? What kind of city do we want to have, sort of at a macro level? I was listening to a TED Talk by David Riesel, who's a neuroscientist, and he juxtaposed whether it was punitive approach or the empathetic approach. And what Jody was just describing, and Lauren said, teen court, we really need to meet these teens where they are. They don't have the social safety net that we, the privileged, are afforded. And as a society, we cannot continue to punish kids that are, have these mental issues or that their growing up life has been difficult. I'm not saying cut them a pass. And it goes back to the fact that teen court is not a pass, but it allows them to maybe be on the trajectory they would have been if they were born into Lawrence Hill's home or Rob Mason's home or Melissa Ross's home. These kids are just, they're not afforded that opportunity.
And it's 549-2937. Cameron in St. Augustine. Hi, Cameron. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
How you guys doing? Yeah, I just wanted to say that, you know, I very much support the program. And, you know, I know a lot of cops in this town, and a lot of cops in St. Augustine are amazing, amazing eyes and, you know, wonderful officers. And but at the same time, as there's that, there's also officers that are not. But at that same aspect, I feel like if you give the officers maybe another opportunity, because sometimes, you know, they get a kid who's got a minor offense and they might not want to arrest him, but end up having to because, you know, it's the law and they have to follow it. If you give them another option as to not take them to jail, maybe he can, you know, it just might be a lot better even for the officers on the streets.
Yeah. Thanks, Cameron. That's Cameron in St. Augustine. Rob Mason, police do have to follow procedure. And let's talk about what the statutes say.
Well, police always have discretion whether or not to make an arrest. The option of a civil citation is just a really good option for them. And we need to realize and we need to give credit to the Florida Department of Juvenile Justice and Christy Daly, the current secretary, and Wansley Walters, the previous, for really making a push for civil citation in the state. And Theda Roberts, who is the statewide coordinator for civil citation, will be appearing at the event tomorrow night to lead off the event by explaining to the community just what civil citation is.
Jerry is in Green Cove Springs. Hey, Jerry, how are things your way?
Wonderful. I just wanted to call and also give support for the program. My son was involved in Clay County and had the opportunity to go through the program. And I will say, the amount of work he had to do to complete the program, they really hold these kids' feet to the fire. They don't let them get away with anything. So, again, I'd like to put my support out there. They do a wonderful job for these kids. And for, like, my son, it was a first-time offense to have a criminal record for something. He was very stupid to do what he did, but it was a minor offense, and to have a record as a juvenile for the rest of his life was a shame. So this is another avenue to just protect them.
Yeah, thank you for
let them learn.
Thank you for the call, Jerry. Lawrence Hills, the program in Duval, similar to the one that he mentioned in Clay?
Absolutely. We work hand in hand. It's the Fourth Judicial Circuit, so the policies that we're talking about today actually apply to Duval, Nassau, and Clay County.
And lots of tweets and Facebook comments coming into the show. Robert, on our Facebook page, why not experiment with the idea of simply taking a 6 to 8 month moratorium on enforcing drug laws and studying the effects as far as actions for other nonviolent offenses? Why even issue a citation? Why not simply call the parents and involve them in the situation? Here's some Facebook comments for you. Emily, thanks for talking about this. ICARE has also been advocating for more civil citations in Jacksonville and restorative justice. They will be at your forum tomorrow night, I believe.
Yes, they will.
Yeah. Here is a tweet from Crystal. She writes, "We need to highlight the fact that Florida is not up to par with other states, and Duval is at the bottom of the list in Florida. We can do better." Ryan, "The difference between a good kid and a bad kid is the bad kids get caught. We've all done crazy things when we were younger." So getting a lot of support out there. Rob Mason, let me ask you to play devil's advocate. People who've watched the news, seen the riots and protests in Baltimore most recently, before that in Ferguson, what would you say to adults watching that who they applaud, for example, the mom in Baltimore who smacked her kid and said, "Don't behave this way"? They want a tough approach. They highly disapprove of teens acting up or getting into trouble. What would you say to those listeners?
What we found is the tough approach doesn't work. We need the smart approach, and that's what civil citation is.
And the sheriff has even said in the paper this morning, it was quoted again, "We cannot arrest our way out of this." I mean, you see our jails, our prisons are overcrowded. We've privatized it. So even on a macro level, we're talking about civil citations, but there's a ripple effect in the criminal justice system.
And in fact, today Sheriff Rutherford's rolling out his PIE strategy,
yes.
Lawrence, prevention, intervention, and enforcement. Civil citations falls under the intervention and prevention parts of the PIE.
Certainly. Actually, it falls under prevention.
Prevention.
Yeah, it's prevention, and it's one of the true prevention programs. Most of the programs that are developed, diversion programs that are intervention after an offense has already taken place. With this program, it's in lieu of an arrest. So from that standpoint, it's a true prevention in that it's preventing an arrest record for these young folks.
Greg in Jacksonville. Hi, Greg. What are your thoughts?
Hello. I just wanted to reinforce one of your earlier callers. You talked about the mental health of the young people. I've been a police officer for 20 years, and I can tell you, when police officers suffer from traumatic situations, we have plenty of help, and we have teams that come out and we get counseling. And the same trauma that we see, a lot of these young people see that trauma on a weekly basis. And they rarely, if ever, get any assistance. I can give you an incident. My wife is also a police officer. Worked a situation where there was a triple homicide. Children witnessed young men that were shot dead in front of them. And my wife organized with the help of the sheriff and got the approval of the sheriff to organize a mental health workshop for everybody in that community that witnessed it. And she partnered with a local pastor, passed out flyers, got the community involved, and people came out and really appreciated it. And we see this on a daily basis and don't realize that the trauma that these young people suffer, it builds upon them and builds upon them, but yet they have no release for it. And I just want to thank that caller earlier, the young lady who expressed more eloquently than I ever could the need for the mental health services for these young people. And thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Greg, thanks.
Yeah. To that point, I would like to explain that prior to us getting a civil citation grant, we did not drug test every kid that came through the program. We only drug tested kids that actually had drug offenses. Since then, we've been drug testing every kid that comes through the process, and we're finding that 64% of them are testing positive for at least marijuana. These kids are self-medicating. They're trying to deal with stress. They're trying to deal with trauma that they've experienced. And additionally, recently, one of the murders that we had here in town, a young lady that just came through the process, her mother passed away in a violent murder on the north side just 2 weeks after she came through the program. So we're trying to get mental health services to this kid. It's a trend that we've seen since the beginning of this process. And every time you watch something that's traumatic that happens with an adult on the news, understand that typically there's going to be a child that witnessed that did not get any mental health services.
Right. That's such an important point. And here's an email from Stephen. It seems clear that the state attorney and the JSO are aligned against civil citations. Is that true? And where are the candidates on this? There was a sheriff's debate last night. The two men running for sheriff, Mike Williams and Ken Jefferson, have you reached out to those campaigns and pressed them on where they stand?
We have, and they're hopefully going to be at the forum tomorrow night. And both of them are pro-civil citation. I spoke with Mike Williams just a few days ago. The trick is to get it down to the line-level patrol officers to get the total buy-in. And that's what we're going to need to do to get better numbers in Jacksonville.
And I don't think, too, that anybody will come out and say, nobody's against civil citations.
Yeah.
Everybody agrees it's a good thing. And it's important that the commission, so the callers understand, too, that the commission presents all sides of the issue. I think where it comes down, and I can't speak for Ms. Corey, but my understanding of it is the implementation. How far? There are certain offenses, I believe, that office has determined should not be qualifiable. And so that's the kind of information that the listeners, if you come out tomorrow evening at the main library, we'll be discussing, and they'll have the information to make their own adjudications.
And isn't the state attorney's office is not on the same page with, say, the public defender's office on which types of offenses should fall under this, correct?
That's correct. The only offenses that aren't qualified statewide are cases involving sex offenses, firearms, or gang-related. So that's the starting point. But in our circuit, it's been whittled down to offenses that just don't qualify, and that's why we have such low numbers.
David in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, David. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Thank you so much. I grew up in Baltimore. I saw what happened, was very disturbed by it. I'm wondering, I grew up in the inner city, and my parents were so much a part of my life and my growth and my development. And I'm wondering, instead of the civil, and I agree with the civil citations, totally, I do, but don't you think there's something as a prerequisite to that that we can do as a society, the police department, individuals, mostly the parents? Why are they not being addressed in all these conversations? Why don't they maybe, I don't know, get involved maybe when a child is brought into the judicial system? Why aren't the parents there to, take responsibility also?
David, thanks for that. Lawrence.
Yes. Two-thirds of the kids that come through the program are living in a single-parent home. We actually have about a third of the cases that are coming through that actually don't have any parent. They're staying with, in some cases, grandparents, in some cases, great-grandparents, who just don't have the energy to put into doing those type of things. Now, the Neighborhood Accountability Boards is the closest to what you're describing, and it allows the community to come together and actually take a kid and give that loving and the paternal type feeling that that individual may be lacking. So the Neighborhood Accountability Boards are trying to address it, but we want to be clear that this isn't your parents and it's not my parents that they're dealing with. They're dealing with very young parents that don't have the knowledge. Some of them are misguiding the kids themselves. So we definitely need to intervene and have a community approach, and that's what the Neighborhood Accountability Boards does.
And so with all of that said, this community dialogue is tomorrow night
at the library at 5:30 p.m., and we will have food there. So please come on out.
Thank you both, all three of you, for being with us and giving us this preview. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Melissa.
We were joined by Lawrence Hills, director of the district's teen court and Neighborhood Accountability Board, attorney Rob Mason with the Public Defender's Office, and Crystal Freed. She's chair of the Jacksonville Human Rights Commission. Again, that community dialogue on civil citations is tomorrow night at the downtown main library. Much more still ahead later. How the old downtown Bostwick building will soon be reborn as the Cowford Chop House. But up next, marking Public Service Recognition Week, we'll tell you about it. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9.
This summer, WJCT will introduce several new programs to our weekend schedule. We want your help deciding which new shows come to the First Coast. Starting May 10th, tune in Sundays at 1 o'clock for a special preview of The Moth Radio Hour, Snap Judgment, Wits, and Studio 360. Help us decide what you hear on 89.9. Get more information at wjct.org/weekends.
New name, new look, great information. Join us for our annual Women's Health Conference, Girls Day Out, August 15th, Hyatt Regency Hotel. Good for You is a day of celebrating women's health planned just for you. Great speakers, great food, health screenings, and so much more. Hosted by Baptist Health and WJCT. For a complete list of speakers or to purchase your tickets, log on to WJCT/goodforyou. Makes a perfect Mother's Day gift.
Relax around the clock with the music of your life. Playing great music from Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald to James Taylor, Joni Mitchell, and more. Relax Radio, WJCT, 89.9 HD3. Learn more at wjct.org/relax.
Never know how much I love you.
Welcome back. Well, Public Service Recognition Week is underway from May 3rd through the 9th. It's a time set aside each year to honor our nation's public servants, and they come in all stripes. UNF's Department of Political Science and Public Administration is marking the week by hosting a rollout of its new Master of Arts in International Affairs. And a special event will feature guest speaker John Caulfield. Mr. Caulfield recently retired after a 30-year career with the State Department. He's a specialist in Latin America with postings in Venezuela, Peru, Mexico, Brazil, and also assignments in the Philippines, the United Kingdom, and Portugal. We're pleased to welcome John Caulfield and UNF Professor David Schwambaird to the studio now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. And John, it's my understanding that you're going to be talking about the U.S. interest section in Havana, Cuba, as part of your discussion. Is that right?
Yes. I was the chief of the U.S. interest section in Havana until last July, and I retired from the State Department after a long career in September.
Yeah, 30 years with the State Department. So incredible stories, I'm sure. So much to ask you about, but I want to begin by getting your thoughts. Now that you're retired, I suppose you can speak freely your opinion about the president's decision to normalize relations with Cuba. The first ferry service in decades is opening up this week between the U.S. and Cuba. What are your thoughts about this monumental change?
Well, I think the president put it pretty clearly himself. Is that what our policies of trying to get Cuba to change by restrictive measures, by sanctions, hasn't paid off, and that he thought, well, you know, we should try something else. And the other way I would look at it, and the way I always ask myself a question about our policies, is what is the impact on the ordinary Cuban people? Because I saw that through my experience that it was very difficult to change the actions of the Cuban government, but we could see that particularly when the President Obama came in and allowed remittances by U.S. citizens, Cuban Americans basically, and for Cuban Americans to visit their families, this dramatically improved the life of ordinary Cubans by allowing them to maintain contact with their family members in the U.S. and because of the assistance that those family members were able to give to their relatives in Cuba, which literally let them put food on the table.
Do you think that the further opening up of relations will continue in this path of helping ordinary Cubans?
I definitely think it will be advantageous to ordinary Cubans. I don't necessarily think that it's going to force the Cuban government to change politically, but nothing else we've done has. The Cuba will change as the revolutionary generation, the generation of Fidel and Raul Castro, passes. These leaders are all in their 80s. They're not going to be there forever. And things will change as they leave the scene.
David Schwambaird, this is just a preview of John's talk this evening on the UNF campus as the school marks Public Service Recognition Week.
Right. Well, we are the Department of Political Science and Public Administration. We have a master's degree program in public administration, and it was actually George Candler, the director of that program, that initiated this. We also have a new degree, as you mentioned, in international affairs, which is an interdisciplinary program but housed in the political science department. And so we are producing the public servants that are going to be serving North Florida, perhaps the national government, local government as well. So it makes sense to bring in somebody with a lot of experience that shows, among other things, what public servants can do for us.
Right. Young students might not think of a career with the State Department as right. an option for them. You spent 30, I'm sure, incredible years with the State
yes.
Department, postings all over the world.
Yes, I was a Foreign Service officer. And for those interested in careers, at the website state, as in statedepartment.gov, under careers, it talks about Foreign Service careers. And we're the people who staff our embassies. And there's an examination that is presented that you can take a written exam, and those who pass that go on to an additional selection process. But each year, we probably take a couple of hundred new Foreign Service officers, and it's a little like it's a hierarchical structure. You start out as a vice consul and then move up through your career.
What attracted you to that?
From the time I was a kid, I always wanted to travel. I wanted to see the world, and So when I was in high school, I tried to figure out what were the careers that would allow me to do this. And I discovered the Foreign Service, and that's what I wanted to do. I studied international relations in Latin America in college. And then I was fortunate enough to pass the Foreign Service exam and to join at a very young age and have a wonderful career.
So Public Service Recognition Week honors servants like John, but many others as well, people in all manner of roles and jobs.
Right. Well, we are in a position, we're trying to promote the professional side of public service. The image in the United States of public service is not always a positive image, and it's very interesting because when you look at research, when you look at survey research, people always remember the bad experience they had with government. But in the surveys, usually most people, most of the time, are satisfied with what they get. And when you have a good, well-developed, well-educated bureaucracy, public service, the government runs, you get your services, you get satisfaction, and we want to promote that and promote that idea.
Yeah, people only notice when the mail doesn't arrive or the government offices aren't open, things like that, right?
When we have the shutdowns,
The government shuts down.
Right.
Yeah. And so after so many years with the State Department, what would you say to young people who are maybe considering this type of life?
Well, I just felt that my career was a tremendous gift from my country to me. And if I were wealthy, I would have done this for free, but I was a poor boy, and fortunately I was paid a salary to do it. But it was a wonderful opportunity. But I think more broadly, what I enjoyed is, as a diplomat, I was always a negotiator. I was trying to find commonalities, find agreement, and whether it's dealing with a citizen who wants to help somebody get a visa, or whether it's an airline trying to negotiate a landing rights in a country. So it's very rewarding to me, and I think all of us who work in public service get that reward out of seeing that we're able to help a person accomplish what they want or get qualified in the way they want.
Sure. So John's talk is tonight, 6 o'clock. On the UNF campus.
Yes, and we're going to have also the sort of rollout of the new Masters in International Affairs. We're having potential students come, some of the faculty, some of the alumni from the public administration program. And so seems like the right way to celebrate Public Service Week.
All right. Well, it's fascinating to get this preview, and we thank you both so much for being with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much,
Melissa.
UNF's David Schwambaird and former State Department official John Caulfield joining us this morning as we mark Public Service Recognition Week. Back in a moment with a look at plans for the new Cowford Chop House. That's next.
Morning Edition is awake around the clock to bring you the latest news.
It's 2:10 in the morning, so still 5 hours left.
The hosts are usually here around 3:30.
You have Ophibia at 4,
uh-huh.
And it's about the Boko Haram ISIS news over the weekend.
Crunch time is 4 a.m.
until 5 when the show starts.
Hit it. Open.
Good morning, I'm David Green. With
Morning Edition, up all night to bring you all you need to know. Listen every weekday.
Weekday mornings starting at 5 on 89.9.
Who will be Jacksonville's next mayor? Jacksonville has distinct neighborhoods with unique issues and priorities, including growth, crime, traffic, and investment. Find out where the candidates stand. WJCT has teamed up with First Coast News and the Florida Times Union to present a debate with mayoral candidates Alvin Brown and Lenny Curry. Listen to Face, Brown versus Curry, Monday, May 11th at 7 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT FM.
The Dinosaur Train is rolling into Orange Park.
Thrasher Horn Center and WJCT present Jim Henson's Dinosaur Train Live, Buddy's Big Adventure, on Tuesday, May 12 at 6 p.m. See the beloved stars of the hit PBS series come to life on stage in your hometown for the first time. Join Buddy, Tiny, King, Don, and their family and friends in this fun-filled interactive musical trip back in time. Tickets are on sale now at 904-276-6815 or thcenter.org.
Looking for fresh music? Join us weeknights at 7 for After Hours. You'll hear everything from jazz to electronica, only on 89.9 FM After Hours.
Well, finally, this hour, restoration of an historic downtown landmark is about to begin, and the results should be forking amazing. The old Bostwick building at the corner of Bay and Ocean Streets will soon be reborn as the Cowford Chop House. Jack Klemp, CEO of Forking Amazing Restaurant Group, joins us now to tell us all about this exciting project. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa.
Good to see you, and lots of excitement about this. This has been in the works for some time, hasn't it?
It has. It's been, it'll be 3 years in January that we've been working on this project, and with another year or so to go to complete it.
How did it all begin?
It all began just reading in the newspaper about how the Bostwick family was trying to demolish the space and had a demolition permit in play. And there was a lot of folks that wanted to save the building.
Sure. A historic building right as you come across the Main Street Bridge. It's right there at the corner. It's got the Jaguars murals and where the windows used to be. Artist Jim Draper did those. So you got the idea to put a high-end steakhouse there. How did that idea come to you?
Well, I have a great partner, Fraser Burns, and we were talking about this potential space, and a chop house came to mind. And then we came up with a name, and Cowford, being the old name for the city of Jacksonville, seemed to be appropriate, and so we just went with it.
Yeah, and since it's a 100-year-old building, quite a bit of renovations about to begin. What all will that entail?
Quite a bit. As we've done a lot of assessments on the building, the southwest corner has dropped 3 inches, and it has also moved out a few inches, and that's due to the foundation, which in 1901 was basically a bunch of crushed brick and not a very good base for that size of a building. And over the years, it's just deteriorated really bad. So the first thing that will occur is there will be some fencing that's going to be put up, and we're going to get the building stabilized before we can really start to get the facade and the windows and all the rest of the elements put together.
And how is this going to appear when it opens, the grand opening? What's the vision?
Well, the vision is still evolving, but I will say that, and this is probably where I would get, my daughter would be poking me in the side, but we plan on having a very upscale, chop house with a raw bar. There will be a mezzanine on the second floor with an opening for those that walk in can look up, and those eating on the mezzanine can look down. A really vibrant bar scene, including a rooftop lounge.
Terrific. Yeah, the rooftop will be a huge draw, I'm sure. And it's no accident that you've bought into this downtown renaissance, right?
Well, I mean, we're in the restaurant business as well, my group. We own Bistro X, and we also own Ovente at the Town Center. So we are came up with the Forking Amazing Restaurant Group. And Cowford will be the next entry, along with a few others in the pipeline.
What are some of the challenges you see in making a restaurant like this work in downtown Jacksonville?
Well, and that question's been asked a lot. I mean, a lot of people think downtown is possibly a little premature for this type of a project. But, you know, when I look at the location is amazing. It has a lot of foot traffic. During the day, you have incredible office buildings with tons of people, and they're looking for a place to eat. So we hope to have a very good lunch menu to support that crowd and that opportunity. But when you look at what is going on downtown with all the things that are here every night, there's some event, whether it's the Florida Theater, Metropolitan Park, Hemming Plaza, the Jaguar Games, Armada. I mean, we just feel like we have a really good opportunity to have a thriving business.
The timing's right.
Well, I appreciate that.
You think? Yes. Yeah. Now, let me ask you, too, about just how you've seen the dining and restaurant scene in this city evolve over the years. How do you assess that evolution?
I mean, Jacksonville has never been on the cutting edge. You know, you get a restaurant here or there that, starts to, do something new and good. And I think, and that's what we're trying to do, too. We're trying to bring a better dining experience and service experience for those guests that come into our restaurants.
So this is high end. It's not going to be fast food. This is going to be a fine dining, white tablecloth experience, right?
Yes. Yes, it will be.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't want to say it's going to be a high end. I mean, obviously, you can go as high end as you want. We'll have some other opportunities for those patrons that, you know, want to just come in and get something quick and leave.
Let's talk, too, about the involvement of the DIA, the Downtown Investment Authority, providing grant and loan money to help you pay for these considerable renovations to this historic property. That's a major assist and a welcome one, I'm sure.
It is. And, you know, we first learned about the DIA and the opportunity that this building would present to them. And they've been incredible to work with, Andra Wallace, Tom Daly, and the mayor have all supported what we're trying to do. And, you know, we've provided them the plan, and based on the historic renovation of this building, we qualify for these funds. And we will use them very judiciously and to make this building restored to its the way it was.
The way it was, what once was, the old Bostwick building. What
Correct.
A history. Will there be anything in the Cowford Chop House that sort of marks the history of the building, do you think?
I think the history will be better read in a book. Where this is a new chapter.
And, right.
We have it's the Cowford Chop House now, the old name. Had it served its purpose, but now it's going to be repurposed.
How long have you been in the restaurant business?
Well, that's a good question.
Your daughter's sitting over there laughing. I'm not sure why.
Back in 2005, I had the notion to purchase a tract of land at the town center and open up a pancake house, the original pancake house.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
There was a little vertical integration there because I'm in the egg business as well.
Okay.
And so, but that concept did not work well. And so we operated 5 or 6 years and it just didn't work. So we changed the concept and came up with Ovente.
And that's working.
That is working.
Yeah, it's a great place.
And I've got some great partners, a great support team, including my daughter that's sitting right here that doesn't want to talk, along with a team that is just doing a really good job for us.
And the restaurant business is fraught with failures. All the stars have to align for a place to really take off. But it sounds as though you have a lot of goodwill and momentum at your back for this entity to take off and be part of something bigger, which is all of the energy and momentum in the urban core.
Yeah, I mean, we're in a really good position right now, my partner, myself, and our team, and we've got great chefs and a great management team at the restaurant level. And the great thing about having more than one is we can do some cross-training where chefs can work at different restaurants with one executive chef overseeing the process, and even management that can float in between the restaurants. So there's lots of room for opportunities with the people that come to work with us to advancement, and we like, you know, the way it's headed.
And so renovations start in several weeks. When does the Cowford Chop House open to the public?
It's a secret.
See, no, it's just you and me talking here, Jacques. Come
oh,
on.
Yeah, you and me and who your listeners. We're saying summer of 2016.
Okay.
And we're hopeful we can meet that timeline. I think we can, and a lot of work to do between now and then.
Well, kudos, and we will be waiting here down the street with anticipation. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jacques Klemp is CEO of the Forking Amazing Restaurant Group, as he talks about his new venture in the old historic Bostwick building in downtown Jacksonville at Bay and Ocean Streets, the Cowford Chop House, opening next year. And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. This show's producer is Sean Birch. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Shevchik. If you've got questions or comments about the show, we always want your feedback. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to catch our daily podcast. Never miss a show. Just go to iTunes and search First Coast Connect. Next on Diane Rehm, the Islamic State claims responsibility for a planned attack outside a Texas art show that featured cartoon depictions of the Prophet Muhammad. New questions on the reach of the extremist group, political tolerance, and the limits of free speech. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.